At the Vancouver Olympics yesterday, the men's 500-meter speed skating final had to be delayed for over an hour because of problems with the ice. After the first half of the race, the ice resurfacing machines left the oval marred by slushy puddles and ridges. Bad ice, said U.S. skater Shawnee Davis before he pulled out from the race. It took three Olympia resurfacing machines and much consternation before the oval was deemed fit for racing. So, what happened? Well, Jamie Gibson is here to explain. He's assistant director of operations at the Verizon Center here in Washington. That's the NHL venue for the Capitals. And Jamie, more importantly, you have been resurfacing ice for 23 years. Now, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you know what you're talking about. You looked at the footage last night, right?
Yes,
Vancouver.
I was watching.
To me, that looked like a pond that I would have skated on when I was growing up. Big ripples in the ice. What do you think happened?
Well, there were a couple things. The one that I saw was the ice was actually, we call it crawling. The surface tension of water, pure water, and you try to use pure water when you're making ice. The surface tension of water is greater the purer it is. So if the ice temperatures run too low, it'll actually pull together and leave wrinkles on the top of the ice.
So it kind of buckles.
Yeah.
Now, is that a problem with the resurfacing machine or with the temperature of the oval itself?
It can be a combination of things. It can be the water's too pure. It can be, you know, different things. Hmm. So.
Well, let's talk about these resurfacing machines. We probably know them as Zambonis. The ones in Vancouver are actually Olympias. Mm-hmm. How do they work? What do they do?
Both machines have a blade that runs across the ice in the conditioner. That's the part that drops down and touches the ice. They've got wash water to rinse the ice in front of the blade, and that gets recycled back into the tank. And then they have ice-making water coming out the back. And then any ice that's shaved goes through the horizontal conveyor, when it's thrown to the vertical conveyor, and goes up in the front of the machine.
Would this be an ice maker's nightmare, worst nightmare? I mean, this is the most high-profile venue for the most high-profile event.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. That's a tough one.
When you were watching, what were you thinking?
I felt for the guys, because when you've had things happen yourself, it's tough because you're the one they're looking at. Even though you might not be in total control of the situation, there's a lot that goes into ice making. The water you use, the building conditions, the outside conditions, and there's a fine line because what you're basing everything on is the surface temperature of the ice.
Have you had this happen to you, ripples on the ice like what we saw last night?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Sometimes worse than others, but yes, I've had it happen.
And what would you do to fix that? Do you have to scrape it off and then resurface the whole thing?
There's a couple quick fixes, but in the Olympics, they want everybody under the same conditions. So whatever you did for those first skaters, you have to continue. So with the Olympic Committee and dealing with them, it's kind of a different situation. They can't do the same little fixes we might do.
Mm-hmm.
You have to give everybody the exact same temperatures,
ice,
same rate. You're trying to give them the exact same thing that the skaters before them had. So some quick fixes would not be acceptable in the Olympics.
And you could tell the coaches were upset. They were skating around and saying, this is unacceptable. We're not going to make it.
Well, there's no way they could have skated on the ice. When it's almost like spider webbing all over the ice when it crawls, and it's rough. It's hard to skate on.
Jamie Gibson is the ice guy at the Verizon Center here in Washington, D.C. He's the assistant director of operations. Jamie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
All Things Considered continues in a moment. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. If you're browsing through Netflix or your local video store trying to steer away from the new releases and find something special to watch, Leonard Maltin wants to help. The film critic suggests his favorite unheralded movies in his new book, 151 Best Movies You've Never Seen. Leonard Maltin, you couldn't stop at just 150.
No. You know, my editor said odd numbers are more intriguing than even numbers. That's an old show business axiom. I hope it's true.
So 151 movies, you call them unfamiliar films that failed to find a large audience for one reason or another. And let's start with one film that you love called The Pledge from 2001, directed by Sean Penn. And when you look at the lineup of actors, hard to imagine that this film didn't do better than it did.
How could a Jack Nicholson movie with a genuinely all-star cast fail to find an audience? But this one did.
All-star cast, Vanessa Redgrave, Helen Mirren, Sam Shepard, Robin Wright Penn, Benicio del Toro, goes on and on and on.
It's an amazing cast. Obviously, they all liked the script, wanted to work with Jack Nicholson, wanted to work with Sean Penn. And it's anchored by Nicholson in a wonderful performance. I understand why the film wasn't hugely popular. It's a downbeat movie, but it's really good. Very compelling story.
What do you love about it?
Well, I love watching Jack Nicholson anytime, anyplace, anywhere. And here he plays a really interesting character. It's a man on the Reno police force who is about to retire. In fact, he's having a retirement party when a call comes in that there's been a crime. A little girl in the community has been attacked.
Jerry, for Christ's sake, you're retiring.
I still got 6 more hours.
As far as I'm concerned, you're gone. It's a Prolix case. He's in charge. His call.
It's fine with me. If you want to leave your own party,
my coat's upstairs.
He meets the parents of this poor, unfortunate girl, and he gives them his pledge that he won't rest until they capture the perpetrator. And it haunts the rest of his life.
There are a lot of indie movies in this book, and I was intrigued by the description of one of them called Chop Shop. It's about young Latino kids who are basically fending for themselves in Queens, New York. Let's take a listen.
Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, sorry for the interruption. My name is Alejandro.
And my name is Carlos.
We are not going to lie to you, we are not here selling candy for no school basketball team. In fact, I don't even go to school, and if you want me back in school today, I got candy for you.
This came out a couple years ago from director Ramin Barani. Tell us about it.
Oh, he's one of the brightest talents on the American independent film scene. This is his second feature, Chop Shop. And he says he likes to make films about people you don't see depicted in movies. And he's true to that goal. This is about this young boy who's on his own, fending for himself in a fairly harsh world in New York City. And he's taken in by a man who runs a chop shop, a auto body place that takes in stolen cars sometimes and disassembles them, or just does body repair work. The man who runs it is a nice enough guy who lets him sleep there and teaches him a trade, too, during the day. But this kid is kind of he's street smart, as you heard in that excerpt.
Mm-hmm.
He wants something better in life, though, and he's figured all this out for himself.
You know, Leonard, I think I had seen 3, maybe 4 of these 151 unfamiliar movies you've picked out here, so I'm right in your demographic. There are a number that were made by really huge, great directors, Ridley Scott, Steven Soderbergh. Do you think there are patterns, explanations for why these movies never made it big?
Well, we live in the era of the blockbuster, Melissa, and the blockbuster mentality. It seems to me that movies come along now and they're part of this big marketing machine. But there are an awful lot of films that don't have the money to spend. They don't have those marketing and advertising budgets. They don't necessarily have the most marketable cast members. They're doomed. Bad timing, bad luck, bad promotion, lack of promotion, mispromotion. Sometimes there'll be a serious film that the studio will try to sell as if it's a comedy. I think that's true of The Weatherman with Nicolas Cage, which is a really good movie, very bittersweet film, but it has some humor in it. So all the previews and trailers use the comedy to try to sell the movie, and I think people catch on to that. I think there's an aroma of snake oil that people detect.
They stay away.
And in fact, what happens is everybody loses. The filmmakers lose because the audience doesn't come. They don't come because they don't think it's the kind of film they want to see, but they haven't been told what kind of film it really is.
Most of the movies you talk about in your book are from the last 20 years or so, but there are a few older ones, and I want to talk about one of them, a Frank Capra movie from 1933, Lady for a Day. This stars Mae Robeson as a woman named Apple Annie. She sells apples on the streets of New York, and here's the catch. Her daughter's in Europe. She's coming to visit, and the trouble is that Annie's been pretending to her daughter that she's part of high society in New York. Here's a clip.
Say, dude, she thinks I'm in high society. Wait till she gets a look at me. It's going to be funny when she finds out her mother is Apple Annie.
So that's Lady for a Day from Frank Capra.
And some people may know the remake, which was called Pocket Full of Miracles. Capra himself remade it in the early 60s with Bette Davis as Apple Annie and Glenn Ford as Dave the Dude. played by Warren William in the original. It's an absolutely charming, I would even say captivating film. It's a film that makes you feel better about your fellow man, that makes you feel that life can be better. I think that's a very high form of art. I don't think that's just escapism.
I was struck reading through this book, Leonard, by the number of actors and directors who were telling you that this forgotten movie that you loved was their favorite. Not the one that made the most money, not the one that everybody knows, but that this was their favorite one.
Well, that's like shooting fish in a barrel, Melissa. It's like saying that the runt of the litter is your favorite. A lot of these films are, in fact, labors of love. And if you say to their writer, director, leading actor that it meant a lot to you, that means a lot to them.
And you hear that a lot.
Absolutely. I attended the Los Angeles Film Critics annual awards dinner, and the film Precious won several awards. And so there was a table of people representing that film, including the director, Lee Daniels, whom I'd never met before. And at the end of the dinner, I walked over to him and I said, I just want to tell you, I'm a real big fan of Shadow Boxer. Now, that's his first film as a director that nobody went to see. He looked at me for a minute, startled. He said, you just made my evening. And he gave me a big hug.
Well, Leonard Maltin, thanks for talking to us about some of the 151 best movies you've never seen.
My pleasure, Melissa. Thank you.
And you can read Leonard Maltin's reviews of five more movies he guesses you've never seen, including a romance about the creator of Conan the Barbarian and a documentary on the Apollo space program. That's at our website, npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. The George Polk Awards in Journalism from Long Island University have given a top honor this year to a stranger who's probably not even a journalist. The award went to the unknown person or people who recorded and uploaded video of the death of Neda Aga Sultan. She was shot and killed during a street demonstration last June in Tehran as Iranian authorities began a brutal crackdown on protesters. The award suggests a rethinking of what is and is not journalism by some of its gatekeepers. And NPR's David Folkenflik joins us now to talk about that. David, this footage has become iconic, such an emblem of that protest movement last summer.
That's right. I mean, think about the scene. It was in Tehran during these protests that were swelling with opposition to the regime. She gets out of a car during a traffic jam as she and some friends are headed to protests, and she's shot apparently by a sniper for a pro-government militia. The footage itself is incredibly visceral, and in some ways, as you say, it became a rallying cry for those in opposition. Think of the man standing against the tanks 2 decades ago in Tiananmen Square in China. It became, therefore, not only evocative and illustrative, but in the minds of those judging these awards, quite newsworthy as well.
Do you think, David, that the award here from the George Polk people for this anonymous footage, does it shift our definition of journalism in any direction?
Well, it certainly seems to. I mean, the person or people who did this were anonymous, but also, at least to our knowledge, not professionals. Here you have the use of social media, a platform such as Flickr or YouTube, particularly in this case, getting out needed information. Because they're anonymous and because they're probably not professionals, we don't know if they had any agenda. We don't know their identity, the motivation. And yet the information itself, seemingly verified by professional journalists who have to kind of curate and sift through it, helps to establish that this is newsworthy. I talked today to the curator of the Polk Awards, John Darnton. He said, look, we are not giving these awards to YouTube or to Flickr, to the platforms, but to those who used them and who showed bravery in so doing. And he recognizes, hey, we realize we're opening the doors here pretty wide.
What do you think happens if someday the identity of this winner or winners comes to light?
Well, there's an interesting analog in the Pulitzer Awards, obviously, for print journalism, in which an unnamed photographer in Iran several decades ago, after the takeover of Iran by the revolutionary forces, the Ayatollah, there was a firing squad, an execution of 11 Kurdish men, and the photographer's identity was withheld to protect him. A reporter for the Wall Street Journal figured it out, told the story, identified the man just a few years ago. He was brought to the United States and rewarded for his work.
NPR's David Folkenflik in New York. David, thanks.
You bet.
When he's not visiting the U.S., the Dalai Lama lives in exile in India. Commentator Sandeep Roy is very familiar with the trip between India and the U.S. and the culture shock it can bring.
My mother knew I was becoming American before I did. On one of my earliest trips back to India, I walked into our house and found giant saucepans of boiled water. "You can't drink the water here anymore," she informed me. "You have an American stomach now." It wasn't just the water. A whole culture of food was suddenly off-limits, too. Street food, what we call chaat, fresh, spicy, quick bites with a whiff of exhaust from the bus lurching by. Now when I go home, I watch my Indian friends eat chaat on the street. I am the non-resident Indian clutching my bottled water. I can get the runs just by looking at the chaat seller and the dirty rag on which he wipes his hand. But I craved it. Then I discovered Vicks. In, of all places, Berkeley. Back then, it was a tiny place tucked in the back of an Indian grocery store. The line was out of the door. It turned out there were thousands of chaat addicts like me all over the Bay Area. Owner Vinod Chopra serves hot samosas and freshly fried potato patties with swirls of dark tamarind sauce and pools of white yogurt. When he told his wife he wanted to open a chaat shop, she was horrified.
In India, this type of cuisine is kind of looked down upon as to, you're not a restauranteur, you are just a hawker, sort of.
Now Vicks is a Bay Area landmark. It expanded into the warehouse next door, and it's still hard to get a table. A few crunchy, tangy snacks, and I'm almost back with my friends on the street corner. Almost, but not quite. Vicks is still a restaurant. Then I found Rana and Akash Kapoor. They have an Indian version of a taco truck called Curry Up Now. When I met them, they'd been up till 2 in the morning cooking.
There's kati rolls, which is a whole wheat bread layered with eggs, stuffed with curry chicken and minced cilantro chutney. Golgappas, fried semolina balls, and it's filled with tamarind water and boiled potatoes.
This is the real stuff. Street food right on the street. It brings back memories for Akash Kapoor.
You know, I've loved it since I grew up. In India, the chaat vendors used to come to the house and serve you right outside your gate. So that's how I grew up. That's how my wife grew up, and that's what we like. We like that dirty food.
Here in San Francisco, it's a different story.
We're germ-free for the most part. We're very, very anal. We got inspected 2 weeks ago, and the guy said it's excellent.
It might taste like the streets of Mumbai, but it comes with a health inspector's certificate. Back at Vicks, Vinod Chopra and his son Amod tell me when they go home to India, they're still tempted by the real stuff.
I stopped eating after my kidney disease. So then I had to be very careful of the water especially. But still, I sneak by somewhere here and there.
Yes. Our relatives would call me and tell me, your dad's eating on the streets again. He's eating chaat on the streets again. And I would be so upset with him. But I learned my lesson. I actually got sick eating chaat and had to sit in a middle seat on the entire ride back.
It's probably been 15 years since I've dared. But my American stomach and my Indian palate have finally come to a happy meeting place on a street corner in California. I've realized sometimes you just can't go home again. You don't need to.
Commentator Sandeep Roy is host of New America Now on KALW in San Francisco. You can comment on his essay on the opinion page of npr.org.